So there are pleasures along the way. Individual scenes are just, you know, beautifully realized. Also, as in so many Wes Anderson films, you have when I say cast of thousands, I don't mean extras, I mean movie stars. There are so many names we could give. That would take 10 minutes alone of people who pop up in small roles. You even get Bill Murray as God, right? You know, I mean, you get all of that here.
Welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about F1 and the Phoenician Scheme, starting with F1. So, Mike, this is like, I think, the big breakout summer movie, but I want to start with the fact that it's called F1 for Formula One, and there's a formula going on here. So do you want to start there with the fact that it is, in some ways, it's Top Gun on the ground?
Yeah, let me pick up on those thematic threads there, because this is a case where I'd want to point out that there are at least a few middle-aged movie stars who still have what it takes. They can still deliver. And very specifically here, let's do a head-to-head comparison. Brad Pitt is 61. Tom Cruise is 63, so they're getting into those middle years and then beyond. And yet, you know, these guys still are real movie stars. Even more specifically, let's do another matchup. Director Joseph Kosinski and producer Jerry Bruckheimer. They were the team, if you will, responsible for Tom Cruise's Top Gun Maverick in 2022. So they proved there that, you know, give Tom Cruise, you know, a motorcycle and you know, whatever else he needs, and he'll get business done. He'll do his own stunts to boot. So anyway, you know, that was a case where clearly Tom Cruise showed that, you know what, you know, these middle-aged action stars still have got the pep. And Brad Pitt's a similar situation here, where in this movie, F1, it really is the movie star package. It's an old-fashioned film in that respect. It really, you know, the plot is thin. There's some things that maybe don't quite hold up. You can almost, you know, smirk at parts of it. But you know what? It works. And when a movie star is holding the screen, boy, does he hold the screen. With Brad Pitt, I got to tell you, with the way it's packaged, and I mean on a technical level of how it's shot, there are some halo lighting effects around his hair that would have Greta Garbo envious. I mean, you know, really movie star treatment here. Now, Marie, to your other major point there in terms of a genre formula, this is Formula One and very much in a formulaic sense. And that has its pluses and minuses. The pluses are that with a movie like this, essentially, you don't want anything overly unfamiliar. When I say you, it's kind of a generic you. People like the familiarity. Here's the movie star, and he's got a, you know, an interesting backstory as a character. He's had his troubles, which we can talk more about, and he's still trying to prove it on the track. And you know, with a film like this, he's going to prove it on the track, right? I mean, he's going to be a winner. So you never really worry that way too much. You worry for about 5 minutes and then you don't worry anymore. But that's a plus in a commercial sense. And the film did open well, not huge, but open well, and it's performing. And so it's pleasing at that level. However, you know, on the other hand, it has a running time of 2 hours and 35 minutes. That's a lot. I mean, you know, it moves fast. How can a race car movie not move fast? It does, but it tends to spin wheels. If I'm mixing metaphors here, forgive me. But it really, I think, runs into some problems in terms of pacing, in terms of the basic storyline. Let's put it this way, and I'll only indulge this bad pun once, but there are a lot of pit stops along the way. He goes to tracks all over the world. And yet, on the one hand, you would think that would be interesting, at least at the level of travelogue. Oh, my goodness, we're in this country and we're in that country. But you know what? You don't even get out of the hotel and away from the racetrack. You really see very little of those locations. So you don't even have that eye candy appeal of being in some exotic other place. Even like when they go to the, you know, in the Arabic racing world. OK, put some white sheets on these guys. I'm putting it in almost crude terms, but it amounts to that. Like, OK, well, now they're in you know, Arab language country. So, you know, put some turbans and white sheets. And that's sort of what they do. It's like set dressing. Like, okay, well, these are the guys walking past the camera. So clearly we're in the Middle East place now. And so it really just works at that level. Now, where it actually bored me after a while was, admittedly, I'm not the world's biggest race car fan, so I'm not part of that fan club. And I know that factors in. But there's an almost mind-numbing near repetition, because here's this middle-aged race car driver who's had some bad breaks, and the world thinks he's washed up. He's got to prove himself. So he's got to like win, or at least place an event after event. And he does that in such a grinding way. And as he does that track to track, here's where it runs into additional problems. The film is full, understandably, justifiably, of what I call flash edits. It's like racetrack action and an edit, blip, 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 and you get, these little visual blips. You oftentimes can't quite tell, well, who's actually winning this race. There will be an announcer at the stadium, as you expect, and he's going to let you know who's in the lead and so on. But watching it visually, you don't know, really. It's just a blur, literally a blur at times. And then secondly, does it really matter? Okay, well, he won in this place and second there, and then the wheels came off and there was a crash and all. So there's like incidental differences from place to place. But after a while, it just seems like near repetitious. And so after a couple hours of it, I was feeling sort of worn out. So the irony for me is, for all the fast edits, for all the zip, zip, zip going around the track, to me, it was just sort of deflating after a while. And I felt sort of left down. And so when he finally gets to those final competitions, I had a sense, not so much of anticipation, boy, he win, because of course he will, but more of relief that, good, finally it's over. Let the guy get his trophy and retire.
Very well put. I just want to reiterate some of the things that you mentioned in terms of the formulaic quality. Nobody is going to go into this movie with any sort of anticipation of anything other than the way it goes, because this is that story, the rough and tumble veteran who needs to, prove himself, the losing team, of underdogs, and, the young hotshot, and, he's going to learn something from the older guy. The older guy's going to learn something from the younger guy. That's all baked in. And in a way, I think that it's a flaw in the movie in that it doesn't really go anywhere else. It just follows this formula. But it's obvious that that's not what the movie's about. The movie is about watching all of the cars racing. And one thing I think they did very well is they made it seem, until, like you, I got kind of ground down after 2.5 hours. Formula One racing is not that interesting to watch if you watch it on TV. It's really not that interesting. And it goes on and on and on. But they did make it look exciting, because it was like they put you in the car. And those moments I thought were really effective, because I never want to drive that fast. But for a few moments, you felt like you were.
Well, you make a good point. And in fact, that's an attribute of race car movies. You can go back to John Frankenheimer's Grand Prix in 1965, other movies like Rush and Ferrari and Days of Thunder. And what those films have in common oftentimes is, very smartly on a technical level, they put you in the driver's seat. And that can be sort of an exhilarating thing, because like in real life, I don't drive that fast, but vicariously, it's kind of fun to do that. But again, when the movie goes on and on that way, it's like, okay, I get it. I've been in that seat already. I'm going to take the MTA bus next time. I don't you know what I mean? Like, it's just too much of that. And then what happens is, when that starts to wear thin visually and thematically, you're left with the story. Now, it is as formulaic as we keep saying. What saves it to some extent is the fact that these are likable characters. Damson Idris, who plays the young hotshot, is going to go up against him. They're going to be like frenemies for a while and then eventually friends. Yes, but that, even though it's a totally predictable character arc, it's enjoyable as you watch it. When you see their resistance to each other wearing down, and they're going to really look out for each other. Yeah, it does tug at the heartstrings that way. And it's got a kind of like macho aesthetic where they're these tough swaggering guys, but they're really soft inside, right? And they're going to like each other. And so, yeah, that's satisfying. Maybe not as satisfying as a quasi-romance with Carrie Condon's character, Kate. She's part of the race car team. She's one of the people at the control panels, if you will, and she's an expert that way. And she doesn't want to fall into a staff romance and so on. So you know she's going to resist, but there are going to be some goo-goo eyes and sweet looks across the track and so on. And you realize in some ways, you know, they're going to become at least romantic buddies, and who knows, maybe beyond that. But that's where it really is very formulaic, because you don't know that much about her as a character. She's not that well developed as a character. She's a plot point. And the point there is kind of like grindingly obvious that not only does the Brad Pitt character love his car, but yes, he loves women too. He finds some time, you know, in addition to loving cars, to loving women. So that's sort of reassuring for the audience as well, I suppose. And so I just think after a while, there's just not quite enough either thematically or visually to really hold my interest there. And again, I think it falls into what is a very familiar pit to fall. Sorry, I keep using the word pit. It's a familiar pit to fall into here. Namely, so many movies, and not just superhero movies, but so many action movies operate on another formula or the same formula that, you know, more is better. And I'm oftentimes thinking, no, more is not better. You know, like tighten it up. And you know, if you cut the movie by a half hour or so, it could be really exciting. You know, it would take me along for the ride. Here's where they just came, well, we've got the special effects capability. We've got this visual team of dozens of people working. We got to, you know, justify the paychecks. Let's give them another scene to do. And I know it sounds crass to put it that way, but I think it almost comes down to that. It's just like in that kind of a film, it doesn't know when to quit. It's just like it's firing on all cylinders, and we've got one race and another, and let's just keep going and doing more. But I think audiences, though they're acclimated to long films, at some point need to have justification for it. Like, well, why is a film like this, which plot-wise is really thin, why is it going on and on like this? So I won't go on and on anymore. I turn it back to you.
Well, one thing that is interesting about Formula One is that you make your own car. So the Kerry Condon character is the designer of the car, but they don't really get into the fact that every single team gets to build their own car. You start off with a basic chassis, and then you snap on pieces that you have designed to be aerodynamic. And I think that's the problem with this movie, is it snapped on too many things. It just could not stop itself from using everything, you know, and more is more.
Having recently had my car serviced, I was thinking about this, like, I want to have a pit stop like he does. You take it in for something and they change the tires in 20 seconds and everything, and you're on the road again, right? That's what I want. I don't want to be sitting in some waiting room. I want a 10-second wait. But again, that's where it's really impressive at that level, because it is true to life that way, that, you know, that those pit stops are as fast as that. And not only, as you say, is the car like totally built by them, almost totally built by them, but essentially sort of like partially rebuilt. When it comes to, you know, like we lost a tire or something broke, whatever, you got to get it back on the track as quickly as you can. And this is where props are owed to one of the producers, Lewis Hamilton, who himself was a 7-time Formula One world champ. And so they had somebody on the producer team who really knows it from the inside. And at that level, even though, admit, as I keep saying, it's not my sport, it is totally credible, and the details are there as to how a team like that would work on the track and then up in the booth, all of that. So if you were if you are a Formula One fanatic, you've probably already seen the film. You'll certainly want to, because it really, as far as I know, as a layman, it really gives you great detail that way. But it could give additional detail to your point, Marie. Again, I'm not much under the hood of a car, but it would be interesting to get a keener sense of exactly how they take the basic chassis and then, in a sense, build their own cars, right? The Kerry Condon character is part of the team that actually designs the cars for them. I wouldn't mind knowing a little bit more about that. I don't want a 3-hour movie, don't get me wrong, but wouldn't you like to have a few scenes where they really went into, rather than taking it to another racetrack, take us into the garage, if you will, and have the guy explain why, well, if you sculpt it over here and if you trim it over there, you can gain so much. There's a little bit of that in the film, but I think, you know, the techie in me would like to know more.
Yeah, more inside baseball, please. Now, you mentioned the halo of golden hair for Brad Pitt. What I noticed was how many times he managed to take his shirt off. And he has all of these really unconvincing tattoos, and you see him in this bath of ice water, and I'm thinking, those tattoos are so coming off in the water. But he looks amazing for his age, which is why he is shirtless in so many scenes.
Well, you know, I actually laughed at the one scene where, you know, after a race, you need to relax and get into the tub and so on. But it was an ice water bath. And the way, and this movie is adamantly PG-13, so I don't want to suggest otherwise, but the way that's shot, it's like a big tease, isn't it? Like when that brat will not only take off his shirt, but he's in the ice water there. And every shot is so carefully framed and lit and so on. That's part of the movie star packaging I was talking about before. And this is not a complaint at all. It just, you know, he holds our attention on screen. And you know, for a guy in his 60s, you know, he's still a winner, if you will. I mean, and he knows that. And that's part of the charm of this. Like with Tom Cruise and with Brad Pitt, they know there's still hot stuff, to put it bluntly, right? And everyone on the team is there to accentuate that. So when they walk across the tarmac or the track or whatever, and they have a big grin on the face, you know, life is good, right? You know, you're making millions of dollars from this role and people are paying money just to watch you take an ice bath. What could be better than that?
I hope they were plastic ice cubes and it wasn't really as cold as it must have been. I do want to give a shout out to Javier Bardem, who I thought actually was the heart of the movie. Every time he was on screen, he held my attention. I wanted that character fleshed out more. And he had the best line, I thought, when they were just marveling of how far they'd gone and what they'd been through. And he said, "What's wrong with tennis? Why not golf?" Yeah.
It's a great line. It's a great line. Oh, I got to say, in terms of watching sports on television, the only thing more boring than Formula One racing, I would say, is golf on television, right? I'm sorry, I don't mind confessing. It just doesn't do it for me. But thank you so much for mentioning Harry Bardem, because he's a really fine actor. And, you know, and the acting in this movie does what it needs to do, but he does beyond what's needed. In other words, he gives a really nuanced performance. Because he has a track record, if you will, with the Brad Pitt character. They go way back. There's a history there. And that's kind of interesting to watch. But just simply scene by scene. And oftentimes he will nearly steal a scene by doing next to nothing. Just watch his face, watch his reactions. This is a really skilled actor. And this is how you can take a character that essentially is just another plot point and really make it seem richer than it actually is. So even when I was getting bored with other parts of the film, every time he popped up, I absolutely agree with you there. He really, really livened up the film just simply by his presence. So, and he's another, you know, an actor who doesn't need to showboat. He just knows what it takes to bring the character alive. So I'm really thankful you mentioned that.
Now, when I saw it in the Dolby room because the IMAX was completely full for that entire opening weekend. So anecdotally, this movie is doing amazingly well. What was the turnout when you saw it?
It's actually not doing amazingly well. It's doing well. It's doing very, very well. It opened big. And then, you know, as you and I are talking now, it's been out for a little while. It's doing well. It's not a huge blockbuster by any means, but it's, you know, as we speak, it's performing well. And I think it will have what I call a solid shelf life or streaming life, if you will, because it's a film that's well worth watching. And, you know, and particularly if you're like watching from the comfort of your home, you know, every hour or two, you can take a break and, you know, get something to drink or eat and then come back and there's another race still on there. So I think it's something that, you know, is enjoyable to watch. I'm not sure, frankly, I'd want to watch it again. There are certain scenes in it that are really exciting, but you know, I really don't want to sit down and watch another 2.5 hours of it. Because even before I watched it the first time, I knew how it was going to end, and now for sure I know how it's going to end. So I don't need to sit through that again. But if I were to watch it again, it would be on a technical level because it is like impressively well made, you know, from that standpoint. And also, yeah, Javier Bardem. I mean, he's just a pleasure to watch.
Yeah, I think he was, in some ways, he was the star. I will also say that, you know, it's a guilty pleasure that people like to watch these kinds of sports because you're waiting for the big crash. And I will say it does show you a pretty spectacular crash.
Yeah, and that's actually an interesting sociological point. Like, well, do we want to see that or not see it? Well, yes, we want to see it. So it's like, you know, if you're driving down the highway and you know, you see a bad accident on the other side of the road, how do you respond to that? You know, should you look or should you not look? And if you look, is that part of your entertainment for the day? It's a sort of ghastly thing to say out loud, isn't it? But the extent to which that kind of rubbernecking is certainly not just an American phenomenon, but just simply, you know, the accident scene, if you will. And I almost don't want to follow through on those thoughts because it doesn't speak kindly of me, I guess. But you know, in terms of what are we thinking as we see something that, at least fortunately, watching a movie we can all say, well, it's vicarious. I would never do that in real life. I would never respond that way in real life, but I'm watching a movie. So yes, I want to see a big crash. And in the movie, you're right. You do get a few crashes and you get like a really big time crash and so on. And you're going to tell me you didn't enjoy watching that, you know, and yet should you have enjoyed it? Well, that's something for you and your confessor to talk about. But but the movie does deliver at that level. And really, and I don't mean this as a condemnation, but when people go to the track, they know things like that not only can happen, will happen. Do you really want, you know, it's almost like back to the Roman Colosseum, right? You know, what are you paying for when you go? So I would just, on a more placid note, point out that, you know, tennis is a much less violent sport typically.
What's wrong with tennis?
What's wrong with that?
It is, I think, important to have at least one scene like that. Otherwise, you're avoiding the fact that this is a very dangerous sport. You have to show it. It's like,
yeah, all joking aside on that,
first act.
Well, you know, all joking aside on that, it's absolutely right that, you know, you got to reinforce the point that, yeah, it's not just all fast fun and games. There is genuine danger here. And that's not laugh inducing at all. And so, yeah, as in real life and in the film, when that hits, it actually does. When I say enjoy watching it, I mean, it's like, oh, my goodness, you know, as you're watching, I mean, it's a mixture of emotions, isn't it? Because, you know, push come to shove, you don't want to see people getting hurt there, even though you kind of enjoy the spectacle of what's happening. But, you know, in real life, those are frightening moments, and they're frightening in the film. That's again where, if I watched it again, it would be for those technical reasons of how they actually stage and edit things like that. That really is impressive filmmaking.
And to be fair, I think everybody wants the person to get out in time, but you do want to see terrible stuff happen to the car.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, splitting apart, catching on fire, let's go.
I mean, we could talk philosophically, what's the value of a human life, but we know the value of those cars. I don't know. I don't want to be the insurance company there. That's a lot of money it was went up in smoke.
Well, you mentioned editing. So that actually brings us to a good segue to move over to our second movie, The Phoenician Scheme, which is Wes Anderson. I love Wes Anderson. I love the way he crafts every scene almost like a dollhouse. Everything is, you know, perfectly blocked. There's an incredible amount of details. It looks exactly like a Wes Anderson movie. But the movie itself, talk about problems with the plot. I just kept losing the plot. And then I was just saying, well, never. Who cares? Who cares? It's Wes Anderson. It's like going to a museum. You're there to kind of look at it more than interact with it. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, you know, if we were to give a plot summary, it would take us 10 to 15 minutes just to give a plot summary, and it still wouldn't add up to much, right? It would just be a lot of incidental details and this and that. And I think that's a major problem here in terms of the Phoenician scheme. Yes, I could recapitulate what's essentially about in terms of this mogul played by Benicio del Toro and his family relations and his business relations and all that, but yada, yada, yada. It just it doesn't really add up to much. And I don't have as much enthusiasm for Wes Anderson as you do. I've got more mixed feelings. And to the very point you're making, that again, at the level of craftsmanship, he's superb. Every scene is a well-sculpted gem. You know, it's in terms of the production design, the lighting, just the craftsmanship there. It's really something. And yet what happens here has happened in other films of his, but I think this is like an extreme case here, where an individual scene is just really beautiful to behold and just so impressive. But when you string all them together, what do you get? There's not enough to be gotten here. It doesn't really add up. You know what it is? It's a clever filmmaker who's enamored of his own cleverness. And something central is just not there. It's thematically hollow that way. So there are pleasures along the way. Individual scenes are just, you know, beautifully realized. Also, as in so many Wes Anderson films, you have when I say cast of thousands, I don't mean extras, I mean movie stars. There are so many names we could give. That would take 10 minutes alone of people who pop up in small roles. You even get Bill Murray as God, right? You know, I mean, you get all of that here. And that's actually, you know, kind of fun to watch. But those are what I call incidental pleasures. Those are things like you smile, you smirk, you say, oh, isn't that neat? Look who it is. But that's not, even though the film at 101 minutes moves pretty quickly, what's moving? You know, there's just nothing really to hold it together. What should hold it together more than it does is that character played by Benicio del Toro. He's this mogul who's so controlling in terms of family and business and this and that, that, you know, kind of godlike figure. And comparison's been made with, and I've made them myself, with Charles Foster Kane, that he's someone mm-hmm. who wants to control everything. And in fact, his motto is, if something gets in your way, flatten it. Which he says, and that's very much a Charles Foster Kane sort of thing. But can you buy love? Can you buy affection and so on? Are you just buying things and buying people? But with the Orson Welles comparison, even more so than Charles Foster Kane, I would say, which is the 1941 Welles film, the 1955 Welles film, Mr. Arkadin, which involves a similar type of figure. That's the kind of figure I'm sure Wes Anderson is thinking about here. But thematically, there's much more substance in the Welles films. Here, it's a matter of a movie kind of reference, like that kind of a character. But there's really nothing on an emotional level or on a biographical level that has much weight here. It's just a lot of busyness. I'll give some examples of just how it's like, you know, enamored of what I call movie references. The Benicio del Toro character, he's Anatole Korda. And I think, well, okay, you got to call him something. And they call him Zaza in the film, but Korda. And I thought, well, there's the filmmaking, the brothers team of the Korda brothers in England. I thought, in some ways, this film does look like Thief of Baghdad. It's got that kind of exotic appeal as it goes around the world and gives you these highly artificial, you know, artifice-driven scenes. And I'm sure, I haven't read this anywhere, but I'm sure, why name him Korda? He's got to be thinking about the Korda brothers and what they were known for in British filmmaking.
Zsa Gabor.
Yeah, I thought about that too, and it's just it's about as brainy as she is. But the thing is, when I thought about, you know, Zsa references and quarter references, the movie nerd in me smiles, right? But then after a while, the smile sort of evaporates. It's like, well, but so what? It's, you know what it's like if you and your friends are sitting around getting silly, getting goofy, talking about movies and character names and this and that. That can be really amusing as a kind of parlor game. But you know, after a while, that would wear thin, too. It's like, okay, well, let's have a real serious discussion or at least a serious, silly discussion about something. Here, it's just like all these toss-away references. That's what I'm getting at. Everything amounts to like a toss-away reference. There's almost nothing tethered otherwise to real substance or anything to really care about. And I think that Wes Anderson's started to make Wes Anderson movies, you know? Mm-hmm. I think it can happen that way. What do you think? Speaking of formulaic, he's his own formula.
I think it's sometimes dangerous when people get famous, because then they go back to, you know, the thing that made them famous rather than trying something new. I will say I did not think of Charles Foster Kane. I thought of Elon Musk watching this.
Well, you're giving it more political substance than it has, but no, I understand the connection.
Not so much the political side of it, the rich man who can do whatever he wants and is kind of obstreperous about it. Now, there were moments I did think were very funny in, you know, almost saved the movie. The scene between Bryan Cranston and Tom Hanks was hilarious. And I liked every time Scarlett Johansson showed up, but it wasn't enough.
Yeah, she plays his second cousin. Don't ask me the family genealogy here, but she's the second cousin. But you're right. See, this is where it's a mixed blessing. On the one hand, it's a pleasure to have actors we care about pop up that way. But then on the other hand, sometimes they literally just pop up, right? She's there for a few minutes and she's there and she's gone. And so, you know, these are things that make me smile, but then think, well, either like do more with her or do away with her as a character. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. It's sort of a never, never land of, should I care about this character? Because she just pops up for a minute here and there. Another instance of that, and it had me laughing as I was watching it actually, is Michael Cera plays a tutor who's meant to be Norwegian. He's got the world's worst Norwegian accent. To me, he sounded more like Peter Sellers' Dr. Strangelove. And it actually didn't even bother me. I was just amused by it. I thought, well, once you get into movie land, why not? You know, have him talk that way. Who cares if it's not a genuine Scandinavian accent? It's a movie accent. And that's the level of performance here. They're showboating, but that's what they're being called on to do, right? But you're right. When you mentioned scenes that work well, certainly, Tom Hanks and Bryan Cranston. I mean, you have some good casting, as you would expect in a Wes Anderson film. And these people want to work with them, and they know they're in for a good time. You can imagine they must have had a lot of fun on the set, right? This is one of these movies where you think they had to be having a great time making it. I'm having a less great time watching it, but they must have had a lot of fun making it.
Well, I will give it this. It does feel original in that it does not feel like a lot of movies that I feel were decided upon by corporations and focus groups and algorithms. I mean, it is a mess, but it is an original mess. I think perhaps, though, what Wes Anderson needs to do is turn all of these ideas into coffee table books. What do you think?
Well, you make really good points there that, you know, it's auteur driven and there's much to admire in him as an auteur. But so much of it is just simply the cleverness of it, the look of it, that it is, you know, people talk about his films in terms of like a pop-up sensibility, like a pop-up book or something, or a coffee table book. And yes, there's real visual pleasure in all that. But I think what I would appreciate would be if he actually took all that knowledge and all that skill, and not that it's going to make some super serious movie, but like really turn it to advantage somehow, so that you have fully fleshed out characters and a storyline and thematic material. And yeah, if you want it to be Elon Musk, okay, let it be Elon Musk, whatever, but to do something with it. Here, it just seems like, you know, like a parlor game where he's having fun. And then, okay, it is impressive as fun, but you know what? He's had other films that were more fun. And I think if you look at the resume there, he's certainly got the skill set. If he really like finally totally focused on something, and he's done it before to some extent, but I mean, in the future, looking at head to take everything he's done and think, okay, well, I know I can make people smile and I know I can get everyone to, you know, show up for a cameo, but let's have a point here. Let's have something thematically with a point. And I'm not being long-faced with this and, you know, it's super serious, but, you know, have fun. Yeah. Make it be silly, but you know, silliness also can have some shape and some form and some purpose.
Well, he is the king of mise-en-scene, but hopefully next time he'll give us more. But that brings us to the end of this episode. But don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thank you for listening to Dragon Podcast. You can find this episode and all other Howard Community College podcasts available for your listening pleasure on all streaming platforms, as well as Podbean at podbean.com/dragonpodcast. Thank you for listening.